Harry.
Well, you know, we have people of principle, keeping with the popping peas, who keep this show going. And Ezra Levant was one of them, and our last guest, Clint Hutton, was certainly one of them. And our next guest, Michael Vaughan, the policy director for the BC Civil Liberties Association, can certainly be described as a person of some principle. Michael Vaughan is raising concerns about a new provincial government program here in British Columbia. And even if you're not from BC, you should listen to what the BC government is up to here. The program's called Citizens at the Centre, Government 2.0. Here joining us by phone tonight is Ms. Michael Vaughan. Are you there?
I am.
Hi, thank you very much for joining us. I'm Terry O'Neill, and we're joined by Carrie Simpson, of course, who you've
been
in
touch
with.
Hello there.
Citizens at the Center, Government 2.0.
Doesn't it sound nice?
Well, it sounds very friendly. It sounds very with it. It sounds Facebooky and Twittery. So what could possibly be wrong with a provincial government reaching out to all segments of the population,
putting us at the center,
trying to be with it, trying to engage? What could possibly be wrong with that, Michael Vaughan?
Well, you know, everybody's all in favor of a rebranding exercise, obviously. essentially, I should say that the government 2.0 exercise is a species of a kind of a movement or a program that goes by a whole bunch of other names too. They've really put their PR people to the task on this, not just the BC government, but several other governments as well. So it's also known sometimes as e-government or transformational government. Doesn't that sound lovely? Horizontal government or joined up government. It's got lots of logos, but the bottom
sounds
line,
like a sex club.
yeah, the joined up part, and joined up and horizontal.
Yeah, exactly.
That was obviously to get your attention.
Well, all depends how many, and also maybe the e-government too, if it's e-government. Anyway, I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, spring must be in the air, Terry.
There you go.
That's a hallmark of our show here, by the way. Wild,
gotcha. Well,
wild tangents.
For electronic as opposed to ecstatic.
Okay.
You'll be sorry to hear.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
Calm down, Terry.
Okay.
So the part of the trick in this kind of branding exercise is that Government 2.0 is, in fact, two entirely different things. And one is very good for democracy, and one is actually quite terrible for democracy. And so this kind of two-in-one trick is a pretty standard obfuscation tactic of government programs. So the good kind, I'll tell you about the good part, because you were picking up on that right away.
Okay.
And the good part is about what the government, in its technological strategy for the BC public sector, would like to do with its own information, meaning government information. And what it wants to do, or what it says it will do, is something called open government. And this is a wildly uncontroversial, by no means actually new idea, where they say basically, how about we get our information that you have a right to, you're the public, to you in a kind of a new, sexy online resource somehow, kind of single point access to all the data that's released by government, and, you know, over time will include the broader public sector. So when I say that's a wildly uncontroversial idea, I mean, really, this is about putting government data online. So it's not exactly a cutting-edge 21st century concept, but nevertheless, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. And certainly, if this fosters what, which they say it will, citizen engagement, well, that would be excellent, and nobody has got a problem with that.
Right. This is not. We're not talking about Freedom of Information Office here. We're just talking about, as a matter of course, government agencies and departments put more of their files online so people can access. Is that what we're talking about
here? Exactly. What we might call proactive disclosure of government information. So let's not burden the citizens with having to do a Freedom of Information request and then going to the media and doing all these things. Why don't we give information that belongs to the people in some kind of accessible format?
Maybe that way I wouldn't have had to pay $60,000 to access a file of information at the Federal Canadian Human Rights Commission. I didn't pay the $60,000, but that's what they told me I would need to pay for them to dig up what I wanted to find.
Wow.
About a year and a half ago. Yeah, it was a, anyway, it's a long story. You can Google it and find out about Terry O'Neill
and the
versus
Lynch mob.
Jennifer Lynch.
Got it. Well, like I say, it's very hard to poke any holes into the general concept of what the government would like to do in being more proactively disclosing government information. That's our information as the public. Nobody's got a problem with that. But
So let me stop you there. In a perfect world, extending that, we would, in a way, almost put the Information and Privacy Commissioner in British Columbia, that's Elizabeth Denham, out of business. It wouldn't be need for her. You know, like, it would all be there. We would just have to, you know, we just have to have a computer and maybe there have to be an office to show us how to search or something. But in a perfect world, that stuff would be there. Everything that should be public is all there, and you wouldn't have to make a special application for it. Is that sort of the way you see it?
Well, in a perfect world, you've got it exactly half right.
Okay.
Because, and this is a gorgeous segue into the next sequence here, which is the other part of Government 2.0, because as you know, Commissioner Denham is the Information and Privacy Commissioner.
Right, privacy.
So, the information part, you're dead right about.
Got it.
The next part coming up is not what the government is doing with its own information, but what is it doing with our information.
Of course,
there was a catch.
Of course, because I don't want somebody having unmitigated access to all of my records that the provincial government holds. That's true. Okay.
So, yes, and that's exactly, hence the horizontal and the joined up part.
All right.
So the notion here, it's kind of, you have to buy into a set of assumptions to kind of understand what this is predicated on. The idea here is that government is essentially inefficient on some level because it's vertical, meaning that it holds information in silos. It's not joined up.
Okay.
Now, we started hearing this language really post 9/11. There was a great cry to bring down the silos, meaning we can't have these separate information holdings between law enforcement and intelligence. But that horizontal kind of movement started to basically justify unfettered access to information much more broadly than merely in law enforcement and intelligence. As we all know, that kind of justification started being what kind of the language that we use in the sort of information biz is function creep, started not only creeping but galloping, so that we saw more and more incursions into people's privacy. So that used to be for the justification of security, and we still hear that. Now, the justification is quite often safety. We hear that. Oh, we need all your information for safety reasons. And what Government 2.0 does is it brings the new justification, another S. In case we were popping our P's a little while ago, we can now get sibilant here with some S's. The new justification for why we are going to create citizen dossiers, as we used to refer to it in the olden times, is for better service, they say. Government 2.0 wants to gather all our information from different ministries, different programs, plus, and here's a very important point, culling it from the private sector as well. And it tells us that this is for better service, but of course, we can't help but note, it also facilitates a hell of a lot of surveillance, the fourth S.
Yes.
Can I stop you right there, Michael? Because here at Roadkill, we've paid quite a bit of attention to what's going on, for instance, in the kindergarten classrooms with the data collection out from UBC. Is this all part of this same movement?
It's certainly all part of a lot of the ideologies and philosophies and essential thinking behind that is very, very similar. Indeed.
Well, I'll tell you what concerns me, because and I've seen a lot of this within the work I do. I assist a lot of families that deal with the Ministry of Children and Family apprehension cases. And quite often, now we're into second and sometimes third generation families that I've helped. You know, when the public health nurse finds out that a family that I helped 20 years ago, their now 24-year-old daughter's having a baby, that file seems to follow that child and now that child's child, in a problematic way, I might add. Mm-hmm. You know, will you receive services when you were a child? Most families are not aware that, you know, you're never cleared from the Ministry of Children and Family. There's a government record that will follow you and now follow your children and your children's children. Is this the kind of data that they're going to all be pooling into one magnificent file over each in one of us?
Bingo. You know the model very well, and it really is the Ministry of Children and Families that's taking the lead on this.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, and so that particular culture that has grown up in that ministry is very much being called to the fore in this sort of movement. And just to be fair, so that we kind of parse out two different things, because obviously when you're dealing with a ministry that has the responsibilities that the Ministry of Children and Families do, there is appropriate data sharing. In fact, appropriate and critical. And the difference between the model that the government is moving towards and what we would call the old-time model with the silos is exactly like our health information, which is another piece of what's crumbling in terms of its privacy. If you needed to send information from one service provider to another because it was appropriate, because you had implied or expressed consent of the patient or client, you would push it. It would go either by fax, by pigeon carrier back in the old days, now, of course, electronically, by email or through some electronic highway. You would send the information from one person to another. The government's new thinking is, to hell with that. That just takes time and people and all kinds of, you know, unfortunate inefficiencies. Let's just grab it all. We'll take it all. We'll pull it. We won't push it. We'll pull it into a giant data repository, which is, of course, a huge honeypot for security concerns. That giant repository will then be available. We will disseminate the information through tens of thousands of portals. Anybody who's hooked up to the electronic system and has access can get access to this information. And that way we can, you know, disseminate it as we choose. That would be the government, not the service provider, not an actual human being, make an actual decision that you can hold accountable.
Well, that was going to be
the government.
Yeah, that was going to be my little, insert there.
Yeah, same. But there are, yes, of course, there are appropriate and needed data sharing elements. But this whole model puts the entire control with the government and outside of the control of the client, patient, citizen, and service provider, outside of the control.
Can I ask a question about the concentrate? So we're talking about the proposed concentration of information. Breaking down the barriers between the silos, so it's all readily available in one place at one time. One of the issues that comes up in my mind when I hear that is thinking about WikiLeaks and how easy it is for one person. And in this case, it was a U.S. A fairly low-ranking U.S. Army individual who apparently has been accused anyway of providing some of the getting access to all the hundreds of thousands of emails about U.S. military, internal military and diplomatic conversations, and then leaking them to WikiLeaks. So is that an issue as well from your point of view that not only does government have all of this stuff, and it will have all the this unfettered power to use this information, but also that with that power with that information concentrated the way it will be concentrated or could be if this goes ahead, that it'd be very easy for one renegade individual to kind of blow the whole thing up, either literally or figuratively, or disseminate the whole thing.
Yeah, let's get Kerry Simpson or Michael Vaughn.
Or something. Is that a concern as well, Michael Vaughn?
It's absolutely. And the model that you've picked is essentially the government version of how it works that system internally. This is exactly the same system in terms of the overarching model. Hmm. So a couple of things that you flag there. One is, could a rogue employee or somebody with access do something nefarious? Absolutely they could. But more often, although those people truly and genuinely exist, and we have all kinds of places to point to that one. Actually, before I get off that point, could I just give the Canadian analogy here?
Go ahead, yes.
Sean Brier, the Veterans Affairs critic, who found out that his confidential medical information held in the electronic system of Veterans Affairs had been accessed over 600 times. And his psychiatric records pertaining to his post-traumatic stress disorder, had found its way into ministers' briefs all the way up to the PMO's office. Now, if we think that was a rogue situation 600 times, we are sadly mistaken, and we are further mistaken by noting that the ombudsperson who investigated that, I say, the largest medical privacy breach in Canadian history, and certainly the most egregious, found out that his medical information in the Veterans Affairs system had been accessed over 400 times.
Yeah.
Meaning that clearly there was significant amount of evidence that people were constantly looking in these records, and apparently more than one person, to find something prejudicial.
Right.
Or to screen people on inappropriate criteria, or to do several other nefarious things. So when we say rogue individual, there also can very quickly grow up what would appear to be a rogue culture.
Culture, yes.
And then finally, there's the category which may in fact constitute the largest repository of screw-ups on this one, and that is inadvertent. Somebody can walk out of there with, I'm sorry, an entire database on a memory stick and leave it in their freaking car. If it's unencrypted and the door's unlocked, we have lost hundreds of thousands of confidential records in exactly that fashion. Michael, in fact, we're kind of famous for it.
Yes.
Michael, let me, or ministers that have nosy girlfriends and things.
Yes.
A thought has come to my mind in jumping back to the Ministry of Children and Family model.
Yeah.
One of the big frustrations over all these years that I've helped these various families is their attempts to correct misinformation on the files that are used to determine their destiny. Is there any safety provisions that you're aware of where people can access what kind of information is being held about them?
Oh, well, that's an excellent part of the equation to bring in, because, of course, I've quite been cavalierly using the language of information. The minute that we put it into a database, it gets elevated or reified.
Sure does.
As something that becomes, well, an important fact of some kind.
True.
When quite often it's conjecture, bias, subjective opinion, rumor, hearsay, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And then how do you avoid the prejudice that can accrue to an individual from this completely unwarranted, uninvestigated allegation or surmise? Interestingly enough, I spent some portion of my day today trying to assist somebody who had an allegation, a very gentle allegation, placed against them in a police database, where the police noted that somebody who had come by their table in a restaurant, who they did not know, who seemed to have some connection with their dining partner, that person who came by and said hello and blah, 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 was, according to the police, a known gang member, whatever that category might stand for.
Yeah.
And they got identifying information from the people at the table. And since that time, this gentleman has had some kind of connection with a known gang member recorded on a police database.
Well, that's that reminds me of the story of just a couple of months ago when it was learned that besides the official criminal records that are being kept in was it British Columbia?
Actually, it was the BC Civil Liberties Association that put out the press release. And you sent it to me, and oh, great.
There's also another kind of off-the-records record-keeping that keeps track of exactly this sort of stuff that the police kind of give as much weight to as the official criminal record.
It's the everything catchment of every time we access our database and we have some ability to log it in, we're going to put it there.
Right.
And, of course, what has happened is because that is effectively prejudicing people, and let me give you some other examples, because I think the parsing out the examples is really important, because so often when you start talking about privacy, for people who this is abstract to, they say, well, if you have nothing to hide, why is the big issue? And I spend my whole day picking up the phone, bring, of people who have nothing to hide or are in terrible big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you imagine and this has actually happened. You know those nice folks out in Mission who've been dinged with $5,200 fines for having imaginary grow-ups?
Yes. Yep.
Well, once we remedy that bylaw, which is terrible, once we finish the class action lawsuit and get them some financial remedy for their harms, then we're going to have to go after the police database because they're all in there too as having a violation of the Controlled Substances and Property bylaw. Well, you just try going to the United States with that on your record. Thank you very much. Right? So, again, here are people who've done nothing wrong and are being highly prejudiced by something in a database that they're going to have a hard time correcting. Now, the original question was, you know, what exactly are your, you know, rights or remedies when this happens?
Yes.
Well, in the applicable privacy and information legislation, you have a right to have your information be accurate. So that's very helpful for a certain category of information. But it's not very helpful when it boils down to somebody's opinion. You can't say that you can test the accuracy of their opinion. It is merely their opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And whether their opinion is right or wrong doesn't make it inaccurate that they held it. So part of the problem here is that the capacity to actually make records, having kind of gone exponentially through the roof now, is creating problems that we never really had before, or at least in this scale, because you simply wouldn't create, you wouldn't have access to paper records that included everybody's, you know,
right,
thoughts and surmises, etc.
You would need a warehouse as big as downtown Vancouver to store all the papers.
And it would never be accessible to you while you were, 10 miles away.
Well, not to mention there would be just the natural human nature deterrent from having to go through all that paperwork.
Oh, yeah, so in a way, it's the technology has created this problem as much as, maybe perhaps more than any sort of malfeasance on the part or nefarious motive on the part of any politician or bureaucrat. It seems to be that the technology is driving this, that not only has created the capacity for it, but in a way it's as if people think, well, if we have the capacity for it, then we should make full use of it. That's kind of a McLuhan-esque take on things.
But I already go back to the model that we know is not working. And just so our viewers, this is the document. Actually, I think I linked it to our announcement on this. If you want to go see.
It's in 3D.
what you're getting here. But, Michael, I have a question because, we say this is happening in BC, but as I read the document, it says prevailing trends and technology directions being adopted by other jurisdictions. Is this just limited to BC? And what perked me to that question was your reference to try to go to the United States. You know, is this going to expand across Canada? Is our federal government then going to adopt this wonderful protocol and then start sharing information with the United States? What is happening on this front as far as how widespread is this?
It's a pretty prevalent trend, and if we want to see where we're heading, and in fact the government of British Columbia has sort of taken off its hat and said, we want to be, in terms of their aspirations and who they look to as the model, is the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
Now, because I happen to be an advisory board member of Privacy International, I can tell you that nobody would make that admission if who was aware of the deep irony of being so identified with the world's most prominent Western surveillance society.
Surveillance state, yes.
It truly is. The United Kingdom in so many regards has gone down that road in a quite dire fashion. But one of the places that's less obvious than the 3 million CCTV cameras is that they are the model for the database nation.
Hmm.
And they spend billions, billions, billions of pounds annually just maintaining those data systems. So something we haven't hit on yet when we're talking about service and collation of data and what does it help you do and what are the dangers, et cetera, is what are the costs?
Well, I mean, the first thought that comes to my mind is that this is not about reducing bureaucracy and increasing efficiency, because bureaucracy never works that way. It's always, can we add a new department? Can we have a new budget? Can we have a new ministry, perhaps, with, you know, another 50,000 employees to monitor what British Columbians are doing?
Well, certainly it's, I would put this in the category of a kind of a, it's the techno-utopia thinking, right? Mm-hmm. If we just have enough technological systems, we will be so unbelievably efficient that, you know, just watch us soar. Now, what has that gotten us so far? I'm going to just slip over here. I'm pointing with my hand that you can't see.
That's
I'm sure you can hear the tonal in doubt. Yes.
There you go.
We have that vision now.
Yeah, you got it. Over here, she said, gesturing, the BC ESIS, which is the BC Education Information System.
Oh, yes.
Okay. That was, again, that's a piece of this whole philosophy project to collate data on students in the education system.
Yes.
Now, that system was a contract went out. They hired somebody to do the proprietary software and set up the systems and everything. That company recently went bankrupt.
I did not know that. My wife would be very interested in hearing that, because she's a high school principal, and BC ESIS was for quite a while next to being a swear word in our household. anyway, so...
As it was for... I know the complaints have been rife. One, because the technology was so riddled with... I mean, glitches is a very nice way to say that.
Yes.
Among the things, apparently, that they forgot about is that everybody accesses the system at the same time to input their grade.
That's right.
And so, bingo bango, it crashed all over the place.
Yes.
So, you know, these are the kinds of, and also trying to tie together legacy systems in terms of the technology, and it's very, very challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But here's part of my my ongoing concern about what maybe really is happening here. If we look at the proprietary software, and the BC government has opted for proprietary software. I mean, we're hiring big multinational companies to supply these contracts. I happen to know, because I do a heck of a lot of work in e-health, which is kind of the system that we're talking about, Government 2.0, e-health is like a part of that, meaning the centralized electronic healthcare record database.
Yes. Okay.
Now, in that database, I happen to know, or in that system of essentially allowing a more electronically efficient data transfer, there is a open source software product called OSCAR, and it was developed by MIT, Harvard, and McMaster University. No slouches on the techno front.
No, not at all.
And they developed essentially an information highway system that you could use on open source software. So what I'm suggesting here is we have ways of updating our technology that are infinitely less expensive and much more privacy protective and also good in terms of its efficiency and all those things that we say we want to do. Why aren't we doing it the cheapest way possible and the way that safeguards all these other goods? And I'm left with the conclusion that, quite frankly, because the government wants the data.
Huh. By the way, speaking of new sophisticated and very expensive data collection machines, we're not going to these smart meters with BC Hydro. How does this fit into, I'm not even sure exactly how smart these smart meters are and what exactly they're going to measure. I presume that, from my understanding, they're going to be measuring your power usage at different hours. Correct. And
if you're a naughty peak user,
right now it's just the monthly rate, you use this much power per month, but then have you looked into this at all? Is there any connection to some of these concerns you're raising with the smart meters and the very
well, yes, there is. I mean, on a few different levels. Right now there seems to be some gray area here in terms of just how much detailed, granular data about the kinds of domestic power usages that are going on that the government will actually have access to on a kind of a line item basis. Because, of course, as a surveillance mechanism, if you could get that sort of granulated data, if we actually know when you're in the shower, that's a hell of a lot of personal information.
Okay, yes.
And would be valuable to somebody.
Yeah, I know that the water utilities can always tell when at halftime of the Super Bowl how many toilets are flushing. But anyway, that's
right. So you know, there's some gray in my understanding right now about just how finely granulated these sort of calculations
are. But it is another area where the government is going to be collecting more information and spending mega dollars to get that information.
Exactly.
Now,
we're not even talking about the various health concerns which are starting to be raised about those kinds of systems.
That's a whole other subject.
Oh, why do we know about
that? Oh, the Wi-Fi. Yeah. Because
even
from your Wi-Fi routers and all the rest, that's a whole other discussion.
I would just put it on top like the cherry on top of the
whatever. Thank you for that.
Yeah. You want to come back for that one?
There you go. Okay. Yes, yes.
There's Wi-Fi all around us.
Well, of course there is. One of the thoughts, and perhaps I'm far more cynical than you are, but you talked about because the government wants the information. What company, because I, being the cynic I am, I'm going, what government friends own the company that's developing all this that's going to cost me, the taxpayer, billions of dollars? Has there been contracts established with certain corporations?
Well, we've got the IT contracts. So those in, I think, many regards, have already been issued.
Okay.
In some they haven't, because it's a project in development.
Right.
So we're really at a critical juncture here, and we're at a kind of a place right now where we're completely turned upside down. I want to give you a kind of a feel when we mentioned the companies. It reminded me of the private sector. Right. The government is going after private sector information, and it's going to transform that information into government information, so it can do with it what it will. And where we're seeing this is, right now, the government contracts with a whole bunch of community-based service providers to provide the kind of community-based services that the government just shouldn't really be in the business of, because the community is it's closer to the demographic that it serves. It knows it better. There's a legacy of trust and various other things.
Mm-hmm.
So the kinds of community-based systems are things like social services, transition houses, addiction services, all those kinds of systems, or services rather, in which a relationship, a therapeutic or confidential relationship, is critical. The government is proposing now to say, if we give you any money, whatever proportion of your budget that is, because most of these are societies, so they do a lot of private fundraising, et cetera, but they have some government funding as well. If we give you any money, we own your data. Now, this is horrifying, because right now one of the cases that we've been really pushing forward, because the alarms have gone up with the BC Transition House Society, is, if that data coming out of a transition house goes into the integrated case management system that the government is building, that means that information about women and children fleeing violence will be accessible throughout the province at tens of thousands of portals in a system that could never be secured against those women and children's abusers, and will actually endanger their lives.
So before we go any further down this road, my understanding is that there does seem to be some legislative changes needed, specifically to the Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act, to allow some of this expansion and integration to take place. Is there actually going to be legislation coming forward that you know of in the near future, or is this being just agitated for at this stage?
No, it could be very near. The really telling document, and if you really want to set your hair on end, then what you want
to
read...
I'll just set it on fire.
Okay,
Carrie
okay.
will set hers on end.
Well, here's the reading that you want to do that. It's the government's corporate submission to the Special Committee to review the Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act. And that is essentially where the government throws down the gauntlet.
Ah.
And it says, you know, privacy is so yesterday, and it doesn't allow us to do what we want to do. We're going to update our approach, basically, by gutting the act. So they've announced their intentions quite boldly. I mean, all I can say about that being so blatant is that the candor was refreshing, because usually they're, as I like to say, wielding the mighty sword of vagueness about what they really have planned.
Yeah, and but, you know, on the other hand, there's not a lot of people who pay a lot of attention to this stuff, and even though it's vitally important, as you and I know, I think the government doesn't think there's a big political risk here.
Oh, they don't, and I know they don't. You know, the idea, I mean, what's happening, if nothing else, if you have no interaction with the government or very, very little interaction with the government, you definitely have either some health care requirements presently, or if you have the great privilege of getting older, you will have some soon.
Yes.
And in that regard, I think this is the place that we can make a lot of people really connect with this. The idea that the government is going to hold your health information should send up some red flags right there.
Mm-hmm.
And
the government rather than just your local doctor.
Than your physician,
yeah.
Or your whatever your practitioner is. Like we already have, and this is again very important, because we do have some data sharing systems. If you go into the hospital, your information is held in a system that many people will have access to. You may be encountering 20 or 30 people on a daily basis.
And that's good, because you know I've had hospital situations in the past where it seems to me that they could use a little sharing, where you're just repeating over and over again to every new person you meet the same thing, and it gets a little frustrating sometimes. Don't they know? Don't they talk to each other? Don't they communicate with each other? But so I think in one way it must be good, but obviously you're identifying all sorts of problems when it goes too far.
Exactly. Scale is critical here. And we do have empirical data, because I'm all for evidence-based policymaking. We do have empirical data that says for small-scale information sharing systems, you will see some modest benefit in the efficiency of the system, but also in safety and various other things. So scale is critical. In the big systems, the detriments infinitely outweigh any purported benefits. And the scale at which we're talking right now is province-wide, and the move through Canada Health Infoway is pan-Canadian.
Well, you know, I happened on to this healthy kids program in the United States that was directly then linked to Canada, and I really didn't have a chance to follow it all up and connect all the dots, but my antennas went up right away, and I'm being reminded of those raised antennas as we speak about this, Michael.
Oh, I can see the little... Oh, I thought that was just your raised hair.
No, didn't it come down
yet? Okay, good.
But, you know, this is big, what's going on here. And I just want to tell a quick little story, and then I want to come back and ask you what we should do about this. But an event happened not too long ago that just really ticked me off. I went to get my car insurance, and, of course, somebody had driven my vehicle across the new bridge, so there were tolls owing on it. And I assumed that you could just pay the tolls like you do your speeding tickets. Not that I ever get speeding tickets, people.
No, just rumor you heard, yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, that wasn't the case. I had to drive up to the office that is in charge of taking care of the tolls, whose main corporate office is in France because we didn't keep it in Canada. But when I got there, they refused to take cash. And anytime I deal with anything related to the government, I particularly don't like to give credit cards or interact banking information. I just don't like to facilitate making it any easier to track Carrie Simpson around, right? And this government, what I thought was an agency, which it turned out to, wouldn't take legal tender, wouldn't take cash. So, you know, then I look at what's going on here and I think, okay, you know, this is all my data. And I think for people like you, Terry, and myself and Michael Vaughn, I mean, we're high profile people. People like to be nosy about what we're doing. We may have political enemies. I know that's hard to believe, but I do know it to be a fact. you know, this is very concerning, not only for us, but for those people who, like you say, could be caught up in the system involving child apprehension. I mean, if I had a dime for every person who needed to correct their file and make it accurate, and that would have saved taxpayers a whole bunch of money in the courts and all the rest of it, we would all be rich because I'd have enough to give everybody else some, right?
Yeah.
This movement and I know there's a perception of apathy, but I don't think it's apathy. I think it's like, okay, what are we going to do about it? What can we do about it? Is this thing just a foregone conclusion? Is there a way to put the brakes on? What needs to be done here?
Well, we have some good opportunities. One, although the architecture is pretty spelled out, most of the system hasn't been built yet. So part of what's happening is it's going forward under so little transparency or really the notion, and I've actually heard government officials sort of ultimately so dismissive, people don't care, they tell me. People don't care. 2% of people care. So we're gonna roll this out. To actually register on the kind of the government sounding board here, we need ordinary people to say that they care. Mm-hmm. And I'm starting to see it. And it's so exciting for me because I feel like I've been out in the wilderness as a privacy advocate for so long.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've actually given some talks recently where just ordinary people, they're telling me stories. They're stories I haven't heard before. They're stories like, here's one, where they say, I'm talking about BC ESIS in this particular, and they say, you know, that's funny you would say that because our son's in grade school and blah, blah, blah. And my husband said about some of his report cards, you know, he's been pigeonholed. Something's going on here. They're not looking at him properly.
Mm-hmm.
And could that be the data system? Like, is he got a check mark somewhere on the data system, and now they're viewing him through that lens? And I said, it's entirely possible. When people start feeling the prejudice, not only to themselves but to their children, who may be, characterized as at risk for some reason, or have somebody decide that they have some kind of attention deficit disorder or behavioral disorder that requires some intervention, et cetera, on the basis of no expertise whatsoever, and now it's reified in the database. I think people, and I'm sorry to say, it will be because their ox is being gored,
yes,
are starting to get alive to the issue.
Good. Very good, then. Thank you very much, Michael Vaughn. And I know that you're going to be busy talking about these sorts of issues. You spoke last week, and you have next month you're going to be in Toronto speaking about cyber surveillance and everyday life. There's obviously some sort of interest growing, as you pointed out. I mean, you sound like you're a busy woman talking about these issues. So if people want to hear from you, just as we did tonight. So congratulations on that, and thank you very much for coming on the show tonight.
Well, you know, it's really nice to have enough time to actually unpack these issues.
Right.
So congratulations on your format.
Well, you know, and I just really want to express my appreciation. I think that this is an issue that people have a duty to become aware of and start thinking in a very constructive, critical analysis, if you can, of what we're doing here and where we're going and how it is going to affect you. I know the issues that we've dealt with Kids First, and I actually during the show I had this little thought that brought a smile to my face. It was, you know, the data about your family is going to be defined by your 5-year-old in the kindergarten class when they give this UBC information data, and then it stays with you and your family from here on ever. There has to be some control. There has to be some mechanisms in place to protect the privacy of our citizenry. And so I really commend you and the BC Civil Liberties Association for at least getting us aware of this, and hopefully we can do our part to make a few more people aware.
Hey, terrific. Well, updates as they happen, have us back.
Thank
All right,
you very
and,
much.
All right, and we'll have you back, okay?
Good-o.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night.
Important issue, Terry.
And educational for me. There was a lot of stuff there. Actually, I've been talking about this with one of my sons in the last year or so, who's very interested in this. The second one who's about to go into law school, believe it or not. And this is one of the issues that he's really passionate about.
Good.
This sort of thing. And I wouldn't be surprised if he gets involved in this sort of thing. You know, I talked about the upcoming conference in Toronto, May 12th to 15th, Cyber Surveillance in Everyday Life. There's an international workshop on this that Michael Vaughan will be talking about. If you'd indulge me, there's a lot of different, there's several different conferences and gatherings coming up in the next month. I just want to share with our
I'm feeling generous. I'll
thank
indulge you.
Thank you. On May 5th in Toronto at the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada, one of our favorite groups, is having a day-long policy conference. They'll be talking to experts from New Zealand and Sweden on how legalized prostitution has worked in those countries. And
has worked or hasn't worked?
Well, has or hasn't. And in Sweden, how the daycare approach, is it truly as utopian as we are told? Mm-hmm. So two very important family-related issues that are dear to our hearts. And so all of you people in the Ottawa area, pencil that one in May 5th. At the Lord Elgin Hotel, the Institute of Marriage and Family Canada's day-long policy conference. Focus on Life, an organization, the big annual Focus on Life fundraising gala is happening May 9th here in Vancouver. It's benefits our organization on whose board I sit, that's Signal Hill. And we're bringing in, that's May 9th, Monday, and we're bringing in Jason Jones to speak to us. And Jason is a remarkable man who is a producer of movies, most famous for helping get the funding and producing the movie Bella, which has got a very life-affirming message. And that's his mission in life right now, is to produce these life-affirming, positive, beautiful, touching stories. He's sort of anti-Hollywood, but he's working in Hollywood. And he has some amazing...
He's a Hollywood rebel.
He has some amazing things to talk about. And I had a long talk with him today. I'm writing stories about this for both the BC Catholic magazine and newspaper and the new Light magazine, which is a Christian lifestyle magazine. So if keep your eyes open for all of those and mark May 9th on your agenda if you care to. I'm speaking May 11th, actually, at the Crestwell Center to some university students about one of my favorite subjects, relativism. My speech is Rendered Ridiculous, Modern Relativism's Absurd Manifestations. It's going to be a rip-roaring one. And you've seen on the show little bits of it already because I've used some of my... my little editorial on evil is part of that speech, so that'll be a lot of fun.
Well, the world is gone. It's absurd when you start looking at some of the things that are going on in this world, Terry.
And you know what? A lot of it is out of the realm of relativism. By the way, did you see that, speaking of relativism, Bolivia has enacted laws giving human rights to forests and the natural world. And they're now presenting a petition to the United Nations seeking the same thing. There's a list of 11 human rights.
We better get back on that Security Council.
That's right. Yeah, right. And finally, we've mentioned this before, June 3rd here in Vancouver and 4th, the Third International Symposium on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, sponsored by the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition. That's great stuff as well. That's important. It's great that they're having their conference out here in Vancouver. So some of the things that I'm following, and I may go to, I'm certainly going to be at two of these events, the Focus on Life and my own speech for sure, and probably get to the Euthanasia one as well. And if there are some guests available, connect with any of this stuff. We'll try to get them on the show
as
well.
Sounds like a plan. I'd love to
Jason Jones.
Jason Jones.
Yeah, he's a busy man. I interviewed him today when he was in his car, traveling between Green Bay, Wisconsin, and Chicago, Illinois. And he was hard to get. He originally said he'd be available at 4 a.m. my time this morning. I said, how about making it 7?
We're going to see how dedicated
I know.
You are, Terry.
It was 7. That's one of the reasons I was... anyway, so fascinating stuff. Good show, Carrie.
Yeah.
That
privacy issues, you know, I have to admit, that's just one of the burrs in my saddle. Yeah. I think we have to wake up people and start putting some constraints on.
And speaking of privacy, anybody who contacts us here at Roadkill Radio, we promise we will not give away, sell, or otherwise distribute your email address. And so until next week, that's it. for Roadkill Radio. Thanks, and see you again next week.
Good night, everybody.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Roadkill Radio. Join us again next week for another trip down the superhighway of information, fact, and truth.